And, Sir Gubb, would you like how much?
I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of rebuttal time, Your Honor.
Certainly, sir.
Good morning, or good afternoon. My name is Robert Goad. I represent the appellant, James W. Campbell. Just a brief summary of the material proceedings in the trial court.
We're familiar with
that. Yes, Your Honors. Thank you.
Judge Clements and I in particular.
Save your time.
Yes, Your Honors.
Let me just ask you this. The Supreme Court, of course, in the companion case has ruled. We're clearly bound by that ruling. Doesn't that tie our hands, at least with respect to your first assignment of error?
I believe it does, and I believe the fact that all three of my first three assignments of error were identical in the first case and this case. I believe they were all fully briefed and argued in the Supreme Court of Virginia. My client has signaled to me that he intends to appeal the Supreme Court of Virginia's case to the U.S. Supreme Court. I don't want to belabor the issue with the judges here today, but I think I need to at least ask you to recognize my arguments on brief. I have a brief argument for why the court should go behind the Supreme Court for public policy reasons, but I won't belabor that issue. That's all contained in my brief.
So you would agree, or maybe not agree, but you're not disagreeing necessarily that 1, 2, and 3 assignments 1, 2, and 3 are governed by the law of the case.
I believe right, and stare decisis in the law
you.
Of the
so
case.
You're going to concentrate on assignment 4.
I can't concede that point
for
the purposes of my clients.
Okay. No, I understand that.
So yes, Your Honor, I'd like to proceed with
assignments
4 and 5.
My only request was whether you would concede that we're bound by the decision of the Supreme Court.
I believe you are, Your Honor. Thank you.
We're quite sure we are.
with respect to the last assignment of error. These charges were bifurcated or separated on defense motion, correct?
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree with that characterization. The first charge was initiated when Mr. Campbell was arrested in August 2014. He waived his preliminary hearing. He was indicted in February 2015. He filed a motion to suppress on that first charge in April 2015. And a second motion to suppress based on new evidence, further research, and that was granted on June 3rd, 2015, all in the first case. The trial court gave myself and Mr. Campbell, or gave the Commonwealth until July 12th to decide how to proceed. It was on June 9th, 2015, almost a year after he was initially arrested, that the second indictment came down. And there was never a formal joinder motion by the Commonwealth. The second indictment was simply set for scheduling or trial on the same day that the oral arguments on the motion to suppress and the beginning of the trial in the first case were set. At that point in time, I'd been appointed in that case for probably 5 or 6 days, so we asked the court to continue that out. But I would submit to the court that it wasn't ever formally joined, so we did not ask that it be severed in that regard. That's the distinction I make as to what I assume will be the Commonwealth's argument of approbation and reprobation and invited error. Starting with the second assignment of error, the fifth assignment of error, the standard is a standard of review, which is no standard of review. There's a double jeopardy basis for a motion to dismiss.
No, we're talking about constitutional double jeopardy.
Constitutional double jeopardy.
Well, that's the Blockberger test, isn't it?
It is, Your Honor.
I mean, that's the only test there is anymore for double jeopardy.
And that's right.
Why doesn't this pass muster under the Blockberger test? They obviously don't have, both charges have separate elements.
I think that if the distinction is whether you focus on the conviction orders and what Mr. Campbell was ultimately convicted of, or whether you focus on what he was charged with in each case. The indictment in the first case charged him with basically everything you can be charged with under 18.2.248, possession with intent, manufacture, distribution, sale, and he was ultimately convicted of manufacture. The second indictment charged him simply with possession with intent to distribute, and given that he entered a plea of not guilty and was tried and convicted in the first case, he was in jeopardy for the charge of possession with intent to distribute. It just so happens the court only found him guilty of manufacturing. So while the convictions have separate offenses, separate elements, the offenses as charged contain the same offenses, or same elements, excuse me. So that's why, under Blackburger, we'd submit that he was in jeopardy for the same offense in both cases.
Well, now I'm sort of confused. Maybe you can help straighten me out. Obviously, there are a number of statutes that combine multiple offenses within a single code section. This is certainly one of them. No bill of particulars was requested, so there was a form indictment that was done. It seems to me we look at whether or not the offense for which your defendant is tried a second time for. We're not dealing with a re-prosecution after a conviction or a re-prosecution after an acquittal. We're dealing with the third double jeopardy prohibition, which is multiple punishments for the same offense, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And in that case, don't we look under the Blackburger test, don't we lay the two offenses for which you were convicted side by side and determine if they have the same elements in common?
I believe that if... My argument is that the court should not look at the two convictions. But
that's what the Blackburger test says we have to do, though, to determine if they're the same. I mean, how do we get around that?
I would just argue a good faith basis for an extension of the Blackburger test.
I mean, while you're in the Supreme Court on the other case, maybe you could get them to change Blackburger for you, know, while you're at it.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that had Mr. Campbell been convicted of possession with intent to distribute, then the analysis would be that this is the same offense.
Sure,
and
absolutely.
He was certainly in jeopardy and could have been convicted of possession with intent to distribute. So I would just argue that given that he is in jeopardy for that, as well as other crimes under the same statute, the court in this case should look to what he was indicted for under the constitutional jeopardy. But I don't think I'll convince Your Honor this morning on that, so maybe I should move on to my statutory double jeopardy argument, unless the court has any other questions on that assignment of error. I think the more convincing and probably more the better argument is that this was a situation where Virginia Code Section 19.2.294 applied, and Mr. Campbell was subject to a second prosecution after a conviction under a prior indictment. The court, I think it was Hall v. Commonwealth, said that a review of this statute, the bar only applies when it's the same act, meaning you can't have several different transactions and then say that this statute applies and it's barred, and the court looks to the time, the situs, the victim, and the nature of the act itself when determining whether or not it is the same act. I would argue to the court that in this case it was the same act. It was the same night Mr. Campbell was arrested within minutes of being found. He was in the same place in his shed. The victim in both cases was the public, and the actual act itself was the manufacture and resulting possession of the methamphetamine.
The problem, of course, and you sort of alluded to this earlier, but maybe you can address it more directly. The circuit court here, I'm going to quote, said that, because the cases were set for trial on the same date, although the indictments were on different dates, and the defendant asked that they not be tried together, and the court granted that, there was a waiver, close quote. That's the circuit court's rationale. Now, if that was the case, isn't the court right? I mean, if they were set for trial on the same date and there was a request to try them on separate dates, wouldn't that operate as a waiver?
I would argue that under the specific facts of this case, it would not. Under other cases, I know there's case law that says that it would. I know that there's the case law, and the way I distinguish this case has to do with the timing. I think the case was Slater that had a misdemeanor and a felony, where the misdemeanor was resolved in district court. The felony went on to circuit court to be resolved. That was not successive prosecutions. The case in Phillips, there was a warrant obtained. The defendant was arrested. Later, a subsequent warrant was obtained. He was arrested on that as well, but the charges all started, I believe, at the preliminary hearing stage at the same time, and ultimately convicted at the same time in the same evidentiary proceeding. And I think that the Court of Appeals, this court, should not find that there was a waiver, because to do so would go against the clear intentions of the legislature in passing this statute. The legislature, the court, has said that the intent is to prevent subjecting the accused to hazards of vexatious and multiple prosecutions. And I think, you know, here, as you said, as the court said, this is deja vu. Here we are, round two in this case, with many of the same issues. And it also protects the accused from continued embarrassment, expense, and ordeal. And I think most importantly, it prohibits the prosecution from being able to go through with a dress rehearsal before the actual trial. Now, the language was trial, but I think the argument can be made that it was a dress rehearsal on the motion to suppress. The defense in the trial court initially won the motion to suppress 4 or 5 days before the second indictment came down. So I think it's a reasonable inference that the second indictment was a direct result of the preliminary granting of the motion to suppress, which would have torpedoed the case initially. So given the fact that we have almost a year between indictments rather than a few weeks in the same preliminary hearing, as well as the intention of the legislature, I think to say that this, to approve that type of charging would subvert the intentions of the legislature in passing the statute. That would be how I'd respond to that. I think the factor that the court looks at is the time of institution. I believe those are all my points on my assignment, my fourth assignment of error. The just for the completeness, and I think I have a little bit more time on the fifth assignment of error. The we talked about the same elements of the Blackburger test, but also whether they're separate or single acts that can be used to get around the Blackburger test if they're the same offense. The in this case, as I mentioned under the fourth assignment of error, I think all of the same transaction or occurrence was used. I don't think they were subsequent. So based on that, I would yield to counsel and ask that my remaining time be reserved for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good afternoon. Catherine Adelfio on behalf of the Commonwealth. May it please the court. Code section 19.2-294 did not bar the prosecution of the PWID charge. The defendant waived any statutory challenge when he objected to going forward with the PWID trial on June 7, 2015, and when he asked for it to be continued. At that time, he did not ask for both charges to be continued to a later date. He merely essentially stated that he was not prepared to go forward with the PWID charge. He's not assigned heir to the Commonwealth setting.
When was any double jeopardy or statutory jeopardy argument made?
Your Honor, there was some made in October 2015, I believe. That is when he filed his motion to dismiss the indictment. He did not alert the court in June of 2015 when he asked for the case to be continued that that was a concern. So essentially, as this court has already indicated, he invited this error when he asked the court to permit him to or to continue the case, and this court should not permit him to approbate and reprobate. And essentially, argument with respect to the statutory argument. With respect to the double jeopardy argument, as the court has already indicated, manufacturing of methamphetamine and possession with intent to distribute have different elements. With respect to manufacturing, you actually have to produce the drug, and with respect to possession with intent to distribute, you have to indicate what you're going to do with it. And in this case, that was proved by the conversations with Kevin Lockhart, the confidential informant. I'd also note that there is persuasive authority issued by this court that suggests that that when you produce multiple pots of methamphetamine, you can that can give rise to multiple prosecutions and multiple convictions. So hypothetically, the Commonwealth could have gone forward with the manufacturing charge of one of the pots and then gone forth with the other pot and charged the PWID with respect to that pot. And so for those reasons, double jeopardy did not bar the later prosecution of on the PWID charge.
Let me ask you, this may be an unfair question. We've all acknowledged that we're bound by the Supreme Court's earlier decision in in the, I guess what I'll refer to as Campbell 1. But the Supreme Court cited their opinion in Verez versus the Commonwealth. I think it was, if I remember correctly, it was like a four-part test for determining of which only one part was the nature of the exigency of the circumstances. And it just seems to me that conflicts pretty directly with some U.S. Supreme Court jurisprudence that explicitly states that that the whole point of the exigent circumstances exception is that there is no time to get a warrant. So when you get a warrant, by definition, I mean, how do you have exigent circumstances? So, I mean, I'm just curious because Verez, you know, they relied on Verez and Campbell, and, you know, we now have this arguable dichotomy between the jurisprudence from the United States Supreme Court and the jurisprudence from the Virginia Supreme Court dealing with exigent circumstances that kind of puts us into a quandary here. Maybe, you know, if the Commonwealth has any position with regard to how we resolve that. Maybe we don't in this case, but to the extent that we might be able to put that to bed, it would be helpful to know.
Sure, Your Honor. Well, in this case, as you noted, I think that this is not the case to address that discrepancy. But I think in this case, the officers decided to go forward and actually act on what they believe to be an effect, a proper search warrant when they saw the smoke coming out of the shed. And they went in to protect.
Well, they're to be committed. They got a warrant. They did. I mean, I don't think anybody suggests in either court opinion that the police did anything wrong. I mean, the failure here, if there was one, was either a part of the magistrate or a malfunctioning fax machine, as I recall the case. So, you know, but the statute says what it says, and you know, the question, you know, I guess the question then is the warrant valid? But the whole notion of justifying a search on exigent circumstances when you've actually had time to get the warrant, what kind of guidance do we get from that?
Sure, Your Honor. I think that in this case where there was the potential for the meth lab to explode, that's perhaps a different set of exigent circumstances than when they were merely just preparing to when they were staking out the meth lab, and I'm not sure if that's.
Well, had they not gotten the warrant, I don't think any of us would have questioned that the exigencies would have existed there for the very reasons you're talking about. But clearly, they thought they had time to get a warrant. They did get a warrant. There was nothing wrong with the warrant other than it wasn't filed properly. I mean, it was certainly established probable cause. There were no scope issues or anything like that. The police did exactly what we expected them to do. It seems to me.
Well, Your Honor, perhaps I'd return to an argument I made in Campbell 1, which is that when the officers relied on good faith on the warrant, let me back
up. I'll put you on the spot. But I was just curious.
In this case, Your Honor, I think that, and now I'm forgetting the exact code, is it 19.2-54? In that case, I think that Quintanilla and some of the other cases that were cited in Campbell 1 basically said that the purpose of that statute was to put the defendant on notice and give him the opportunity to challenge the basis for the probable cause finding. And I'd suggest that in this case, because they had the opportunity to do, he had the opportunity to do so at a essentially a probable cause hearing or during the motion to suppress hearing, that that the warrant was not defective or the notice requirements of 19.2-54 were satisfied. And
I won't beat you up anymore about
that. Well, thank you, Your Honor. But just to reiterate, I'd ask the court to affirm the decision of the circuit court. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Gay.
Just briefly, Your Honors.
With regard to the argument of approbation and reprobation and invited error, I looked back over, and I believe I'm correct. The timeline for the second indictment, counsel was appointed on June 12, 2015, and then it was set for June 17, 2015, which was a busy day in the circuit court. It was a motion to suppress first on Campbell 1. It was arraignment on Campbell 1 and Campbell 2, and it was trial on Campbell 1. I do believe I asked the court to let us continue the second case, but I don't agree that the error was invited by the defendant. I would argue to the court that the error was actually invited by the Commonwealth in bringing the subsequent.
Counsel, I don't see it as invited error at all, to be honest with you. I don't see it as abrogating. I see it as a waiver. If anything, it's a waiver situation because if, you know, and of course, we weren't there, so we have to just look at the court's orders, but if the case is set, both cases are set for trial on the same date, and then I think the argument is that when you, if they've been tried together, the statute clearly wouldn't apply. I don't know if there's any question about that. So then the next question is, well, if there's a request to continue to separate them and continue one of them for a future trial, that was done, does that operate as a waiver of the application of the statute? Because obviously, in the absence of that, then the statute wouldn't have applied, and we wouldn't have this discussion right now. So I don't honestly see it as an approbate, reprobate, or invited error situation. To me, the only question is whether the continuance, given the statement of the trial court that they were set for trial on the same date, and its further statement that then the continuance operated as what amounted to a waiver of the application of the statute, whether that's correct or not.
I would just argue that any waiver that happened was kind of forced upon Mr. Campbell because of the new indictment that came down in the very short period of time he had and I had to prepare for and think through a second case like that, 40-year maximum sentence. So we'd ask the court to reverse and remand and conclude that. Thank you.
We'll come down and greet counsel.